Hi, it's Bill Radke. You are just about to enjoy the final week in review of 2017. It's a little shorter this week because we spent about 15 minutes on the radio raising money for our end of the year pledge drive, and we're not going to make you sit through that on the podcast. But I am going to remind you that Week in Review and KUOW only exist thanks to the generous support of listeners like you. So if you've turned to the Week in Review or The Record, KUOW News, NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, to keep you informed in 2017, why don't you head over to KUOW.org right now and give what you can and help keep us here for you in 2018. Okay, maybe pick up some KUOW socks or an emergency radio while you're there. Thank you, and Happy New Year. Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. We've made it. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to catch you up on what happened this week, maybe talk about what's to come and what it all means with my guests, Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Welcome, Joni.
Hey.
Essex Porter covers government and politics at Cairo TV. Good to see you, Essex.
Glad to be here.
Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research at the Free Market Washington Policy Center. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let us begin with what happened this week, the fact that it looks likely you will get the chance to decide whether it should be easier to prosecute cops who use deadly force. Initiative 940 would require more mental health and de-escalation training for officers and make it easier to prosecute them. Prosecutors would no longer have to prove the officer had evil intent. Instead, the question would be what a reasonable officer might have done under the circumstances. Yesterday, supporters turned in more than 350,000 signatures.
The state of Washington has spoken.
Yeah!
Enough is enough. There is enough blood that has been spilt on these streets, and it stops today.
That's Katrina Johnson. Her cousin, Charlena Lyles, was shot and killed by Seattle police in June. The president of the state's biggest police union thinks Initiative 940 is going to have unintended consequences if it's made law.
I understand that the community as a whole, and the community, I mean this entire country, is having a different thought on how they want to be policed. And I think the conversation beginning is a good conversation. But I don't think this is going to help that conversation out. This is going to cause people to hesitate, and there will be lives that are lost. And then it will be, well, why didn't you take action? Because I was hesitating because I thought I was going to be prosecuted.
That is Seattle Police Officer Kevin Stuckey talking about officers pausing, hesitating, and lives may be lost. Paul Guppy, what do you think?
Well, I think this is obviously an important issue, but really what's needed, I think, is more training, de-escalation to make situations less violent when possible.
And that's part of this initiative.
Exactly. And maybe just changing the approach that the police take. It's always a concern. And, you know, here I am, a small government conservative. So what is the most powerful part of government? The part with the guns, the part that uses physical force against citizens. And we need that for crime control, but we also need accountability whenever the government, you know, again, is directing force against citizens. So anything that de-escalates violent situations, more training, non-lethal force, maybe building in more time so that you can negotiate someone out of a dangerous situation.
Like a cooling off period.
Or something that isolates the danger so there isn't public danger, and then dealing with this person a bit separately if that's possible. Again, I know that's not always the case. I'm sure the police would say that there are emergency situations in which they have to act fast. But I think the right approach is to take a philosophy of de-escalating violence and dealing with people who might have a weapon or be a problem in a way that isolates them from the community.
Okay, so that's a balanced answer, yes or no, on 940 if it came to you, and it might come to the voters.
Right. So that's another interesting thing. As a policy analyst now, I would have to read the initiative. But I think the first step is that it's an initiative to the legislature. The sponsors got 100,000 more signatures than they needed. So there's huge support behind this. And I think the legislature needs to deal with it first. And if they don't pass it or pass an alternative, then it goes to the voters. So I want to see that first stage so we look at the details and see what the legislature does.
Essex, it's not going to pass the legislature, right?
It's not going to pass the legislature. The legislature, I've covered at least 2 years of the legislature considering this in committee. I'm not sure it's ever even gotten out of committee. I can't remember. But it will not pass the legislature.
Why? Why is it so unpopular?
Well, because it's unpopular for the reasons that Kevin Stuckey outlines. When it comes down to individual lawmakers, you know, some of them are police officers. Many of them are endorsed by police officers. So police officers who are truly afraid of this really have their ear. And, you know, if a lawmaker votes for this and something goes wrong and a police officer hesitates and innocents are killed, you know, that can come right back on them. Knowing that more than 300,000 people have signed petitions and it's likely to go to the ballot, lawmakers are not really up for the risk of taking this on themselves. Let the voters do it. They've already spoken. They've spoken halfway. They can do the other half.
Joni?
Yeah, and so, you know, the police officers, that is a really good point. They don't want to make a mistake here, but it's also their job to do this work. And, you know, there's this very high threshold right now in our law that makes it very hard to prosecute a police officer.
I've heard it is America's strictest or one of its strictest laws when it comes to prosecuting.
It's the strictest.
Yeah, and so the issue has to do with this word malice. And the unions don't want that word removed. But actually, you know, there is a way to do that. There is a way to make our law not like that. But this, unfortunately, when you're going to have voters deciding this, this is going to get into like a civics lesson, super wonky,
right?
The way you don't want initiatives to make policy. I mean, I could zoom in on like a single point. So, for example, this initiative says that the training commission is going to develop the rules for how folks would be prosecuted. But those don't allow participation from the shooting officer's actual agency. So that doesn't really work. I mean,
what do you mean? Explain the problem.
Well, I'll explain it in that. So if your own agency cannot be involved in the investigation, then that's the entity that can compel the officer to testify and speak and cooperate.
You mean your municipal police department?
Yes, yes, or your county or something
uh-huh.
like that. So you don't have anybody who can actually compel you to testify. And officers have the ability to say, okay, I'll take the Fifth. I'm not going to participate.
But that would be any citizen in any
right.
situation. You certainly this initiative, nor any other law currently on our books, would compel an officer to testify against themselves.
Paul, the Kennewick Republican Brad Klippert, ranking member, House Public Safety Committee, opposes this initiative and said, I think our law enforcement officers, by and large, are doing a fantastic job every day. Why is that the standard, the kind of am I on the side of the cops or not? People who are doing a good job have rules to follow. What do you think of that part of the debate?
Well, in some ways, he's saying something that's obvious and also something that doesn't help the issue. So on the one hand, I think it is right to recognize the hard and risky work that police officers do in every community across the state,
mm-hmm.
usually properly and, you know, without abusing anyone. And 99.9% of the time, I think that's right. And I think police do have to be congratulated for doing an important job. On the other hand, that's not the point of this initiative. And even the sponsors of it are not after all police. They are only trying to focus on the rare occasion in which a police officer violates the rights of a citizen.
Do you think evil intent
is his position?
Do you think malice or evil intent, as it's called, should be the standard or not?
Well, that's another great point I was going to make, is that I'm not sure I'm willing to let prosecutors off the hook when they say that there is nothing that they can do. If you remember, there was a man walking in Pioneer Square with a knife, and he got shot by a Seattle police officer. So this becomes a narrow technical issue, as Joni was pointing out. So I'm not sure I'm willing to let county prosecutors across the state off the hook when police possibly cross the line. And, you know, to fall back on technical language about malice is, I think there could be more effort by prosecutors to look at these cases and possibly charge an officer in a case where it's obviously over the line.
Any final words?
So this is a really, really emotional issue for folks. I had Andre Taylor on Civic Cocktail about a year ago. And, you know, it's clear that something needs to be changed. But the problem with initiatives is that they do it in this sort of, you know, clobber you over the head kind of a way. For example, we're all for training and de-escalation. This measure has no money attached to it. So it's an unfunded mandate. You know, will the legislature? Doesn't sound like they want to touch it. They're afraid of it because the unions don't like it. And so they're not going to provide the funding for this. So that's just an example of the many problems.
I would disagree that lawmakers may not provide funding for training. I think even in the coverage that I've done on the legislature, lawmakers have been very supportive of training and very supportive of the State Police Academy, which would be developing this training, and then that training would be also reinforced at the local level. So I don't see training and the money for that as necessarily the issue. There will be, should the malice standard be eliminated by this, there will still be the good faith standard that this initiative also includes. So an officer's state of mind will still come into play. It's just that the malice standard is nowhere else in the country, and the prosecutors have felt that it's an insurmountable barrier.
Blocks them.
We should also mention that there are law enforcement officers, some high ranking, who actually support Initiative Sign 40 and have signed the petition. It is not a monolithic opposition from law enforcement on this initiative.
That's Essex Porter. And if you just joined us, we've been talking about Initiative 940. They've turned in the signatures this week. This would provide de-escalation training for officers. It would require they give first aid for anyone they shoot. And then we've been talking about this provision that eliminates the need to prove malice as a condition of prosecuting officers who allegedly misuse deadly force. So the state will certify the signatures, theoretically. They have about a month to do that. If it qualifies, then the initiative goes to the legislature. None of us think it's going to pass there. All lawmakers could completely kick it to the voters, or they could amend it somehow, pass a different version, and then voters will have two versions to choose from at the ballot.
So, one thing that would help is we haven't heard from the governor on this. The legislature, the Democrats just took control of the legislature for the first time in years, and Inslee is laying out his agenda for the coming session. And I haven't heard him give a viewpoint on this particular initiative. Now that we know that it's qualified and the legislature will be debating it, some kind of direction or position from the governor would be helpful.
Are you inviting Governor Inslee on KUOW's The Record?
Sure.
Did you hear that, Governor?
Absolutely.
He's a big fan. Okay, let's talk about that, Governor Inslee. That's Paul Guppy with Essex Porter, Joni Balter, back in just a moment on The Week in Review. It's The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm not alone on Fridays. Joni Balter is here from Civic Cocktail, and Paul Guppy from the Washington Policy Center, and Essex Porter at Cairo TV. Hi, team.
Hi, team.
Hey.
So we got something this week on the disaster from December 18th in Pierce County. We heard some of the 911 emergency calls from that fatal Amtrak derailment.
911, what are you reporting?
We've been on an Amtrak train accident. We're south of Tacoma, north of Olympia. Tons of people are hurt.
It's past the Fort Lewis military base heading south to Olympia.
It's an overpass.
And the train is hanging off the overpass. It's landed on vehicles.
Okay, is that Mel's Road?
There's bodies laid everywhere.
Three people have died. Dozens more are hurt. The train was going 78 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone when it hit a curve and jumped off the tracks above I-5. This was a brand new route for that train. And Joni, this week, the Seattle Times reported that some Amtrak workers think there might have been inadequate training on the new route.
Yeah, you know, well, contrary to sort of the first reaction from the president, which was, oh, another example of aging infrastructure. What are we going to do about it? This clearly was sort of a rushed effort to get this new route open. And we're hearing just different parts of that, you know, that the technology, for example, that could have prevented it was in existence but hadn't been turned on yet. The Seattle Times story, I thought they did a really nice job on that, interviewing some of the current and former employees who said they didn't have enough training to be familiar with the sort of problems with the route. And so they quoted some folks saying that maybe they were trained, maybe 3 to 5 sessions in groups, some at night where you couldn't really see all the sort of obstacles that were ahead, and that it would be wiser and more safe if they could have maybe had up to 10 sessions of training, not so much in groups, everybody in the front of the cab so they could see what was coming. And some of these folks were in these groups that were sprinkled throughout. And so clearly, and as we observed in the green room, we were talking about this, a year-long investigation lies ahead. So they're going to get to everything, including, you know, obviously the speed of the train was too fast for the curve. But what did the employees there know? They didn't know enough, and they didn't have the technology that could have prevented this. And this has been required for some time, but Congress kept letting the date slip on this technology that puts these transponders in the rails and then alerts folks. If you don't slow the speed, a beep goes off, so at least you have a chance to slow the train.
Essex, this is not your first NTSB investigation. You'll be covering this.
No, it's not my first. They routinely take a year for almost anything because they are so meticulous. And actually, I have to say it's my colleagues, Graham Johnson and Amy Clancy, who have been covering this most for Cairo 7. You know, one of the things I've gotten from their reporting is the idea that, you know, there was a time pressure to get this done. Because federal money was at stake if the route did not launch soon. And that's one of the reasons that they did not fully complete the testing and the implementation of positive train control.
And that sounds like a wise incentive when a deadline is put on a federal project.
Sounds
right?
like a dumb incentive.
Well, it does in hindsight.
Shouldn't they, you know, if you know that you're not ready to go, can't you call somebody or file something with somebody and say, you know, we're actually not ready to go here. How about an extension so that we can get some of these systems, some of this training and some of this technology up and running first?
And it was the railroads truly pressured Congress for the continual extensions. So it's not like there has to be this special train control to run passenger trains in the country. So, you know, the folks here are weighing that, you know, that's a standard that's not upheld everywhere else in the country. Passenger trains clearly run safely every day without it. So
this is that GPS type right. transponder system.
Right, that would automatically slow the train if it saw it heading too fast for a curve. But you know, if that had been implemented, that would have been another layer of protection to prevent this accident.
So what's interesting about this accident is how preventable it was. It's completely based on either administrative screw up or human error. And even in our high tech world, what's interesting about the way Amtrak runs is they don't run on their own tracks. And so the crew has to know the route personally, and that's what they were training to do, but not enough. So what's interesting is that the engineer running the train actually looks out the window. He's keeping track of landmarks. He knows the routes. The more familiar he is with the route, when a curve is coming, when to slow down, the safer the trip is.
And just like any trip you take, right?
Exactly.
If you start to wisely navigate it because, oh, yeah, I know I'm supposed to go over here and not there. You're not relying on having to see the signs or catch the little official notification.
Or the light flashes or yeah. that, you know, there's a transponder. Those layers of safety are good. But the fundamental safety comes from the familiarity, the training of the engineer with the route. And they just weren't up to that level yet when they started on this trip.
It was interesting to me when this story first broke. You know, the first thought I think a lot of people have was the conductor or the engineer, you know, on his cell phone. I mean, just everybody went there. And they answered that. And this is another thing you know, they don't normally answer all these questions because there's so many details that have to go. And, you know, there's lawsuits coming. Mm-hmm. But they knew from the cameras, apparently, that no one was like, you know, playing tic-tac-toe on their phone, mm-hmm. which is the good news. But that is something that, you know, that is something that the training really wouldn't have been able to
prevent. should we have those similar cameras in airplane cockpits? Because we don't at the moment.
Why not?
The pilots don't want it. They say that it impinges on their privacy.
Right. Over and over again, we have that conversation. Privacy invading cameras to the rescue again, if you, body cameras on officers. We don't want our privacy invaded, but we're glad we have the information when we want the information.
Sure. Well, there's your private life, and then there's being on the job. And especially if you're flying an airplane or running a train, you know, That's not your private life. You're at work, and other people's lives depend on what you're doing. So there's a better case for providing a camera. I understand the pilot's point of view. I would look for results. If air travel is safe, then maybe it's not needed. But train travel obviously needs some improvement, and so we should look at all options to make sure that happens.
Now, I know you're with the Washington Policy Center. When I think more training required, more positive train control required, I think government red tape. I mean, I think in general, the less regulation, the better, right? From your policy center's point of view.
Well,
how do you know when deregulation is the right deregulation?
Well, you know, there's an old saying in political science that the basic thing that a government has to do is make the trains run on time. And so, you know, running a train is a pretty basic thing. And even if Amtrak were a private company, airline carriers, they're private companies and they're regulated for public safety. So the same standard applies here.
So safety is like the point of government, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
So I don't think
there's no debate about that. Maybe with a libertarian you would get a debate, but not
let
the other.
Let the trains run whenever they want.
Right. Not the other 98% of us.
Hey, speaking of vehicular disasters, this week in downtown Seattle, 5th and Pine, a Shuttle Express van plowed through a crowded sidewalk, hit at least four people, ran into the Gap clothing store building. Police think the driver had a medical emergency and lost control of the van. And sometimes we ask, what would you do in this situation? Well, this is unconfirmed, but a park ranger told the Seattle Times that someone passing by the accident scene opened the door of the van, jumped in, and was hitting the driver, yelling, "Don't you go anywhere." This is the driver who we now believe had a medical emergency, but I can only guess this person thought it was some kind of premeditated attack, maybe a terrorist attack, which happens. That happened in New York City and London and Barcelona. So even though this turned out to not be a terrorist attack, do we owe this passerby a thanks for springing into action and doing something that now looks awful?
Seems like the intentions there were good if this story is true. You know, I had just walked by there 5 minutes earlier, so... You know, and then when I came out of somewhere else, the choppers were above, and I thought, okay, that's not your garden variety car accident, because they don't usually want to spend the money, am I right, Essex, to send the choppers out. But clearly that was many people's first response was, oh my gosh, it's one of those vans. Oh, you know, we've seen this happen in many cities in the U.S. and Europe, thinking that it was that. That was like an instant thought that a lot of folks seem to have. And so I would thank that person for jumping quickly.
I would say it's great that they were attentive and willing to get involved, but maybe they went a bit too far, and actually hitting the driver might be too much. We were talking earlier about the role of the police, and this is a perfect example of where concerned citizens keep an eye on what's happening, make sure that person doesn't go anywhere, and wait for the police to arrive, because they will get the facts.
It's a little more than see something, say something.
That's right.
Action-packed. But, you know, we have admired that, for example, when terrorist attacks happen on trains, when citizens go into action because maybe the police aren't standing right there.
Exactly. So that's a case of stopping an attack, which that's courageous for people to step up and do that. In this case, if the van is crashed and stopped, and there's no need to get quite that involved. But I agree with you that it's good that people on the street were paying attention.
You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle, running down some of the big events this week. We haven't even talked about the changes coming in 2018. As of New Year's Day, we've got changes in the soda tax in Seattle, and minimum wage, and paid sick leave. We'll talk about that and more as we continue with Essex Porter, Joni Balter, and Paul Guppy. So stay tuned. From The Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter. From Cairo TV, Essex Porter. From the Washington Policy Center, Paul Guppy. How are we doing on our pledge drive so far? User
fee.
Good, right?
You bet.
Yeah.
Bubble breaker.
That's right. Bubble breaker. You mean people's point of view bubble?
Yeah, that one.
We're breaking the bubble. That's a good thing. Speaking of bubbles, thank you, Joni. Speaking of bubbles, it is time to load up on your pineapple Fanta. Because if you want to avoid Seattle's new bubbly soda tax, it takes effect on Monday, New Year's Day. The city's taxing distributors of non-diet soda pop and the syrups that they put in soda pop, and they're taxing distributors of sports drinks, your Gatorade, energy drinks, your Red Bull, fruit drinks, your Sunny D, that kind of stuff. So the distributors pay the tax 1¾ of a cent per fluid ounce, which for a 2-liter bottle of soda, that's more than a buck, about $1.18. So the drink gets more expensive for you. So maybe you'll drink less sugary nonsense, and maybe you'll be healthier. Great idea, right, Paul Guppy?
Okay, this is where you get that alternative viewpoint.
Okay, bring it on.
I don't think this tax will do anything. I don't think it will discourage people. It won't change consumption patterns.
What makes you say that?
Well, maybe incrementally, but I think overall people are still going to drink the sugary drink. So I don't think there would be much health public health impact. It will raise more money for the city, but Seattle is already an expensive place to live as it is, and taxes are very high in the city. And there are two sort of objections I have. One is I don't like the precedent in our state of imposing a special tax on food, on groceries. We traditionally have made that tax-free.
If you call soda pop food.
Well, that's the point, is that this is kind of a baby step in that direction, so I don't like the precedent. But the second thing is I think it indicates the tension with the city council that on the one hand, they're talking about how expensive it is for workers to live in the city, for low-income people to live here. And then they place a regressive tax on something that low-income people consume. And maybe
so you're for progressive taxes. You want an income tax, right?
That's a different topic, which we could debate as well. You said you only had 22 minutes.
Yeah, true.
Uh-oh.
So,
don't get him going.
I could talk about the income tax all day.
I know you don't like the regressive taxes.
Right. My point is that just kind of calling out Seattle politicians who love to stand up and say how much they, in favor of progressive taxes like the income tax. And then when you look at what they actually do, they are constantly increasing sales taxes, property taxes, and now a special tax on soda. And those are all regressive taxes. So I guess my challenge is...
Well, Seattle politicians, of course, would respond that were they given the opportunity to use progressive taxes, they would do so.
That's my point.
And perhaps even reduce the use of regressive taxes.
Fine, but then let them make the first step, I guess, is my challenge to them. Instead of always complaining about it, show how they could actually reduce regressive taxes, and I think that would put them in a stronger position.
Like passing an income tax? Hey, they did that.
Again, that's a topic we can debate. And by the way, if they had passed a flat income tax, they would have been in a much stronger legal position instead of going all the way to the progressive tax that they passed.
So, Mr. Uh-huh. Guppy, where were you on the topic of higher taxes for cigarettes? Were you in favor of those?
Again, it's the same problem. It doesn't seem to do much to deter cigarette use.
Au contraire. Au contraire. So
public health, if there's a public health benefit, then there's an argument there.
There's a giant public health concern and benefit. And
right,
some of the studies, other cities have done this. I know that Cook County, which includes Chicago, passed it and then took it back. But other cities and some of the national studies have found that people are already making the social change, switching from drinks that they don't need, that are just vapid, empty calories, that actually are very directly tied to obesity and diabetes, and people are switching. And one of the reasons given in the national study, quoted in Obesity Journal, said that the taxes are themselves contributing to that change. So
let me cite just to one study that gets at what you're saying. But it also gets at something that Paul is saying. One example, Berkeley. Has a soda tax. 1 year after it took effect, sales of sugar-sweetened drinks fell by almost 10%. Sales of water increased by about 16%. Sales of unsweetened teas and milks and fruit juices went up. Quote, "I was really quite surprised, to be honest," says lead study author Barry Popkin of the University of North Carolina. "Berkeley already consumes fewer sugary drinks than the rest of America. They're highly educated and higher income," which could be talking about Seattle. That's end of quote. So what the study did not show, however, is that soda taxes make people healthier because the amount of calories saved was too small to be statistically significant. And we know that people can get their unlike cigarettes, they can get their sugar from other places.
Exactly. So it didn't take into account shifting to another place to buy your soda, and Seattle might experience the same thing.
Maybe.
As the city becomes more expensive.
In covering the story, I spoke with a gentleman who has an independent burger stand just right on the border, just the Seattle side of the border of White Center. And he's truly worried about the impact on his business, and in part because you know, he uses the syrups to provide the fountain drinks. There's really quite a margin on those. And that's something he can use to keep prices down for other portions of his business. And when that goes up, he thinks it could even double what he has to charge for soda drinks. And people can literally walk across the street and get them for less money because the sugar tax doesn't apply in King County.
But there is evidence, Joni, as you're saying, that people do change behavior. Now, you should be, listener, be skeptical of any single study, and I'm not going to cite a whole bunch of studies, but the impression I get from reading is that people do, that's the reason, that's one of the reasons you tax something, is that you want less of it. They say that when the minimum wage goes up, that's a downside, right? There's going to be fewer jobs. Well, when you're taxing sugary drinks, the theory is that people will respond to that, and they'll take less of it.
And they did
and
so
it's
with,
bad for
they
them.
Did so with cigarettes. As the taxes kept going up, and the same argument came up about how this would hurt small business, but behavior changed.
I didn't make that argument.
But I'm making the argument.
Okay.
But behavior changed. And so you hit these things, these health problems from a variety. You know, why is behavior changing? Because people are more aware that they don't want to be obese, that there are really big costs to society of being obese and having diabetes. So education's part of it. But some of these same businesses are making money off a bottle of water like they never did. You know, all of a sudden, you know, in the last 10, 12 years, everybody buys bottled water. There's a huge margin on that as well. And so as consumers change, businesses have to change.
Businesses just adapt to whatever the rules are. I mean, you could put a $20 tax on sodas and they would just charge the tax. I don't really think so much. I do feel for small neighborhood businesses, especially convenience stores. They're often operating on very thin margins. But to me, the larger argument is just making Seattle harder to live in. It's just another incremental increase on top of everything else. It's all added together, and the city council seems to be insensitive to that.
Again, this is a Seattle tax. It's expected to raise about $15 million a year. It will go toward healthful eating programs. It'll go toward low-income kids' education programs. The city's Fresh Bucks program helps people using food stamps buy more fruits and veggies at farmers markets, food banks, soup kitchens, even some retraining for workers, if any, are being put out. That's the new soda tax taking effect on January 1st. We mentioned minimum wage. It's going up, Essex, actually, to the famous $15. That's finally happening this in 2018.
Yeah, that's what really strikes me is that we've talked about $15 an hour for so long here in Seattle. Only now, because it was all phased in very slowly, is $15 an hour actually going to be the wage for people at larger companies in Seattle, not still for folks in the small businesses.
And I'm sure, Paul,
here we
that
go.
Now you're going to tell us that you tax something and you get less of it.
Right.
In this case, jobs.
Job creation. So again, I'll just repeat the same point, that businesses will simply adapt. The reason there isn't huge pushback from the business community about the minimum wage is because most businesses either don't already pay well above the minimum wage, so they feel they're not affected, or they just adapt to whatever the rule is. The problem becomes the effect that it has on people who are trying to get a job. So every time we raise the bar on creating a job, we make some number of people unemployable. So that is young people, the disabled, immigrants, people with low skills who are just trying to get their first foot in the door to get that first job. And as we all know, the most important job we've ever had is the first job that we have, because that's a chance to prove
it. My job at Dairy Queen was the most important job I've ever
had.
Chuck E. Cheese, technically Chuck E. Cheese.
Right. So
they would not let me be a character because I was too tall for the costume, so I had to work in the back where things were hot.
Wait, you broke the costume?
Sure.
That was the most important job I ever had.
Exactly. So somebody gave you a chance. They hired you to see how you would work out, and you did work out, and everybody wants that same opportunity. And every time we impose another restriction on hiring someone, there's some invisible, voiceless group of unemployed people who find that they are facing a barrier.
Yeah, but some folks who are earning that are noticing that they're doing a little better and they can maybe spend more.
Sure, if you have a job or keep your job,
mini marts, they have more money to spend at the mini marts.
But it creates an incentive for automation. So employers will say, I'm going to do everything I can to avoid hiring people in the first place.
Dishwasher at an Air Force mess hall here. But the thing I'm concerned about is what happens when there's a recession? And, you know, Seattle has had an extraordinarily long growth period. We are theoretically overdue for a recession. So things are doing fine now because we have a prosperous economy. But what happens when there is a recession?
That's exactly what is covering the whole story and all the analysis that's going on of the minimum wage. That's, you know, the big fight that's been going on in this city about really what was the impact. University of Washington says, oh, well, didn't mean fewer people were necessarily hired, but it meant that some folks were maybe going to lose some hours. And so in essence, they maybe wouldn't get the full benefit of what was imposed. But when you compare this to the soda tax, the pop tax, that'll tell you what region of the country you're actually from, depending on how you answer that question. But there's a difference. You know, you don't need to drink soda. It is not required that you drink soda. What is required is if you're a small business, maybe a restaurant, you need the dishwasher. You need the server. You need the people. So you must do that. You must hire them.
But there'll be fewer of them because what restaurants in particular will do is move towards automation. So that's where you have automatic ordering and, you know, touch screens at your table, things like that.
You know, Paul, you're right. A more efficient way to redistribute wealth would be an income tax. Oh, wait a minute. That's
we'll be back on that.
Okay. All right. And finally, one last thing. We're not going to have time to talk about it now, but so you know, kicking in on New Year's Day statewide, because Seattle already has and Tacoma already have paid sick leave, but now it's going to be statewide. Voters approved that initiative, and it gives most workers the ability to accrue sick leave part-time, temporary. You get at least an hour of paid time off for every 40 hours you work.
And that's the civilized thing to do if you think about it. It also breeds loyalty in employees, and companies will benefit in the long run because they won't have to waste their time looking for new employees. Paul's ready to dive in. He's ready to dive in. So I think it creates loyalty. I think it's good for women workers, single moms and that sort of thing, because maybe the last bastion of sexism in this country has to do with care of children and care of the elderly. A lot of women are doing this work, and they need a break sometimes because someone is sick, someone's in the hospital.
By the way, I do a lot of childcare. I just want you
to
know.
No, I'm sure you do because you're one of those evolved guys, but I happen to be related to some that are just a little less evolved.
Ouch.
Not my
Let's invite that person on
no,
the
not
air.
My
Not your husband, obviously.
No, clearly. So, clearly my brother.
Again, you know, the mandates like these are popular because they feel generous, just as Joni said. But the problem with them is that they're mandatory and they're one size fits all. So what it does is it doesn't take into account people's individual situations. So someone is forced to have family leave when really some workers, a single person, for example, might say, you know what, I'd rather have more pay. I'd rather have more hours. I don't want the family leave. You can keep that. But I want to be compensated in another way. So it's kind of like squeezing a balloon. Every time that the government imposes a restriction in one area, the employer has an incentive to take away a benefit in a different area. Because
and you know
he
what?
Has to make the payroll all balance out. So again, family leave sounds great, but there are some people that would prefer not to have it, and they may want to earn more salary instead.
You know what? Same thing goes for the week in review. If you squeeze one topic,
income tax,
the other topic's going to have to shrink. So let's pause there. We've been telling you about some of the changes, the rule changes that are coming to you in 2018, and we're going to come right back and wrap up the week in review, so don't go away. Week in Review, wrapping up now with Paul Guppy and Essex Porter and Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. A year and a month ago, right after President Trump was elected, I asked Seattle's retiring liberal congressmember Jim McDermott for his take, his perspective on the Trump presidency, and he said, basically, calm down.
This is not the last day that the sun is going to shine. Tomorrow morning, the sun's going to come up. I'm wearing a Cubs jacket because I'm a Cub fan for my whole life. I understand losing and being told to wait till next year. But the fact is that if you persist in a good idea, you're ultimately going to succeed. It's a question of your willingness to persist.
The sun did come up a few times in 2017.
But not in the last couple days.
Any take on President Trump's presidency as we kiss 2017 goodbye?
I guess the sun will come up another day, but it's been a rough year with this man as the president, and that's absolutely true for a lot of folks. You have to give him the win, if you want to call it that, on the tax bill. Republicans love tax cuts, so if they couldn't pull that off, I don't know. But I still think there will be a big reckoning here in 2018, November. I think it's going to be a bloodbath for the Republicans because, you know, everyone goes, oh, the economy is so amazing.
Even if the economy is fine, the stock market's great.
The economy is
ISIS
roaring.
Is on the run.
Well, this presumes that the Democrats actually get organized, which they have.
They don't even have to be that organized. I mean, it's going to happen no matter what.
But that's a year from now. People change their minds and feel
microphones fall.
Yeah, microphones fall. Yeah. But people change their minds and feel differently. You know, 2 weeks later, a month later. Mm-hmm.
That's all true. But, you know, look, the economy's very, very good. Some of it inherited from Obama. And at some point, we'll give some credit to Mr. Trump for that. But this president has the lowest approval rating in modern times of anybody while the economy is shining like the sun and all of that. So there's something else going on, and it has to do with the president's inability to be a decent human being and his Twitter nut fad craze that he's got going. And he's people find him, especially women voters, especially millennials, find him kind of gross on a good day.
Well, remember, majority of women voted Donald Trump.
True.
Exactly.
And a majority of women in Alabama voted for Roy Moore. You know, women have a very nuanced take.
I'll agree with that. But remember, the year began with the inauguration and then the Women's March.
So Trump is a disruptor. That's the main thing. The first thing he did in 2016, starting in May, was he destroyed the traditional Republican Party, and it hasn't been rebuilt yet. So Republicans in Congress in particular are still trying to figure out whether they should associate themselves with Trump or not. After the tax bill, they're feeling better. But if Trump stumbles in 2018, you could expect
What I mean is if Republicans— You mean when? Trump.
Okay, fine. But what Republicans have to calculate is, do they want to be associated with this guy or not? So far, Trump has kept a whole raft of campaign promises, whether you like them or not. But Trump keeps announcing, I promised I would do X, and then he does it. So he's building a record in that sense. But Republicans, as an establishment party, still haven't figured out how to deal with them, and they're going to have to spend 2018 doing that. Trump does not play by Washington, D.C. rules or the media's rules. He does his own thing, and that's what he feels that he was elected to do that. On the Democrat side, Congressman McDermott is exactly right. Persistence in a good idea is the way to fight Trump. So resistance feels great, yelling at the sky, but that doesn't build a program for an alternative political party. And I think that's what Democrats have to do in 2018, is not just to say we're against Trump and we vote against everything he proposes, but that they have an alternative program.
I can tell Essex wants to talk in the minute we have left.
I just wanted to ask, Paul, do you think that now that Republicans have the tax breaks they want, that they will now be more willing to abandon Trump, not to support him every time something outrageous is done?
We got the tax cut.
It's more expensive. It gets more expensive to be his friend as time goes on.
No, Essex is making a great point, is that it takes the pressure off. So the failure of the health care vote put a lot of pressure on Republicans to pass tax cuts. Now that they have, they'll have more discretion on other issues.
Okay, that's it for 2017, and we'll get back at this again starting in the new year. Will you come back, Joni Balter, Essex Porter, and Paul Guppy?
Be happy to.
We'll be here.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Civic Cocktail, Cairo TV, Washington Policy Center, respectively. Great to see you on the Week in Review. Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Mm-hmm. Happy New Year.